Winter came, and the city turned monochrome. Black trees against gray sky, above white earth. Night now fell in mid-afternoon, especially when the snowstorms rolled in. Boundless prairie storms that set the sky close to the ground. The city lights reflected against the clouds. The work was tougher in such weather. Mounds of fine white powder blew through the cracks of my car, down my collar and into the openings of my coat. On rounds of interviews, I never spent enough time in one place to thaw properly, and parking spaces became scarce on the snow-narrowed streets. Everyone, it seemed, had a cautionary tale about fights breaking out over parking spaces after a heavy snow, the resulting brawl or shooting. Attendance at evening meetings became more sporadic. People called at the last minute to say they had the flu or their car wouldn't start. Those who did come looked damp and resentful. At times, driving home from such evenings, with the northern gusts off the lake shaking my car across the lane dividers, I would momentarily forget where I was, my thoughts a numbed reflection of the silence. Marty suggested that I take more time off, build a life for myself away from the job. His concerns were professionally explained. Without some personal support outside the work, an organizer lost perspective and could quickly burn out. There was something to what he said, for it was true that the people I met on the job were generally much older than I was, with a set of concerns and demands that created barriers to friendship. When I wasn't working, the weekends would usually find me alone in an empty apartment, making do with the company of books. I didn't heed Marty's advice, though, perhaps because, as the bonds between myself and the leadership grew stronger, I found them offering more than simple friendship. After meetings, I might go with one of the men to a local tavern to watch the news or listen to oldies, the Temptations, the OJs, thump from a dinged-up corner jukebox. On Sunday, I'd visit a church service and let the women tease me over my confusion with communion and prayer. At a Christmas party, I danced with women old enough to be my mother. I talked sports over stale cheese puffs and meatballs with husbands who had been reluctantly dragged to the affair. I counseled sons or daughters on their college applications and played with grandchildren who sat on my knee. It was during such times, when familiarity or wariness dissolved the lines between organizer and those I was supposed to be organizing, that I learned the most about the work I had chosen. I learned that the self-interest I was supposed to be looking for extended well beyond the immediacy of issues, that beneath the small talk and sketchy biographies and received opinions, people carried within them some central explanation of themselves, stories full of terror and wonder, studded with events that still haunted or inspired them. Sacred stories. Not to say that everything I learned from the leaders cheered my heart. If they often revealed a strength of spirit I hadn't imagined, they also forced me to acknowledge the unspoken forces that retarded our efforts, secrets that we kept from each other as well as from ourselves. That's how it was with Ruby, for example. After our aborted meeting with the police commander, I had worried that she might back away from organizing. Instead, she had thrown herself headlong into the project, working hard to build a network of neighbors that could be regularly delivered to our events, coming up with ideas for registering voters, or working with school parents. She was what every organizer dreamed about, someone with untapped talent, smart, steady, excited by the idea of a public life, eager to learn. And I liked her son, Kyle Jr. He had just turned 14, and in all of his awkwardness, one moment frisky and bumping into me while we shot baskets together in the neighborhood park, the next instant bored and sullen, I could see all the contours of my own youthful struggles. Sometimes Ruby would question me about him, exasperated with a mediocre report card or a cut on his chin, baffled by a young man's unruly mind. "Last week he said he was going to be a rap artist," she would report. "Today he tells me he's going into the Air Force Academy to be a fighter pilot. When I asked him why, he just says, 'So I can fly,' like I was stupid. I swear, Barack, sometimes I don't know whether to hug him or beat his skinny behind." "Try both," I would tell her. One day, just before Christmas, I asked Ruby to stop by my office so I could give her a present for Kyle. I was on the phone when she walked in, and out of the corner of my eye I thought I saw something different about her, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was. Only after I had hung up and she turned toward me did I realize that her eyes, normally a warm, dark brown that matched the color of her skin, had turned an opaque shade of blue, as if someone had glued plastic buttons over her irises. She asked me if something was wrong. What'd you do to your eyes? Oh, these. Ruby shook her head and laughed. They're just contacts, Barack. The company I work for makes cosmetic lenses, and I get them at a discount. Do you like them? Your eyes look just fine the way they were. It's just for fun, she said, looking down. Something different, you know? I stood there not knowing what to say. Finally, I remembered Kyle's gift and handed it to Ruby. For Kyle, I said. A book on airplanes. I thought he might like it. Ruby nodded and put the book inside her purse. That's nice of you, Barack. I'm sure he will. Then, abruptly, she stood up and straightened her skirt. Well, I better be going, she said, and hurried out the door.